I'm Jane Clayson, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Fired NPR news analyst Juan Williams went on ABC's Good Morning America this morning to criticize NPR for letting him go, based on his comments on Fox TV this week that he fears Muslim Guard passengers on airplanes. Williams also criticized NPR CEO Vivian Schiller for what he said was a personal attack. Schiller had to apologize yesterday for saying that Williams' feelings about Muslims should be, quote, between him and his psychiatrist or publicist.
I don't understand why she has to get that low. She has an argument to make that I somehow violated some journalistic ethics or values of NPR. Make the case.
NPR is being pilloried today in editorials in major newspapers. From the Wall Street Journal editorial, quote, NPR's progressive political base was unhappy with Mr. Williams' appearances on Fox as existentially incompatible with their worldview, end quote. NPR has received more than 15,000 listener comments on its webpage, which crashed from the volume yesterday. The NPR ombudsman says an overwhelming majority of the comments are angry, furious, and outraged. Some listeners are demanding refunds. Joining us on the line is Frank Sesno. He is director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. Frank, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Has NPR made a major mistake here in firing Juan Williams?
Maybe. They certainly made a mistake, I believe, in how they fired him. They have been concerned for some time about his increasing role with Fox News, the increasingly noisy, what I call shout TV programs. NPR has in its ethics code, which is a public code, a flat-out explicit statement that its journalists, and they consider Juan a journalist, should not engage in punditry and speculation, but in fact-based analysis. And they draw a distinction between analysis and commentary. Now, that's fair enough. Every news organization has a line in the sand. CNN fired Lou Dobbs. They fired Rick Sanchez when they stepped over the line. NBC fired Don Imus when he stepped over the line. And so I think that there's been a growing concern about Juan on the part of NPR. What's unfortunate about this is that this has now somehow gotten conflated with accusations of censorship and this unfortunate comment about psychiatry and all, when what it really is about is the media news culture wars.
Well, as an analyst, wasn't Williams doing what he was hired to do? I mean, I'll back into the question by saying that NPR has sent out talking points to stations, advising station managers to tell listeners that the firing was, quote, difficult but principled. The NPR ombudsman writes that while the situation was poorly handled, she agreed with the management that Williams had become more of a liability than an asset. And then I'll quote the Washington Post, which in an editorial today sees it quite differently, saying, quote, Mr. Williams was attempting to do exactly what a responsible commentator should do, speak honestly without being inflammatory. His reward was to lose his job, end quote, from the Washington Post. So, again, wasn't Williams doing what he was hired to do?
Well, let me say that I am a friend of Juan's. I have enormous respect for him. And I think if you listen to what he was saying, in fact, he was saying it in a somewhat provocative but thoughtful way, outspoken though it was, slightly higher decibel though it was, that is, in fact, what an analyst or a commentator is supposed to be doing. The issue really is, what is the voice that NPR wants to have? NPR has a voice. It is generally thoughtful, lower decibel. It is not shout TV. And I think that what NPR was doing was saying, wait a minute, that's not censorship. That is NPR saying, this is our voice.
As you well know, Juan Williams sees it much differently. In an essay posted on the Fox News website, he wrote that, quote, this is evidence of one-party rule, one-sided thinking at NPR that leads to enforced ideology, speech, and writing. It leads to people, especially journalists, being sent to the gulag for raising the wrong questions and displaying independence of thought. I'll wrap up with you here, Frank Sesno, and ask, you know, what's the impact here financially and journalistically on NPR? I know conservatives such as Newt Gingrich, who of course led the charge against government funding for public broadcasting in 1994, said yesterday that Congress should investigate NPR for censorship, consider cutting off its public funding, which now is only about 2% of its budget. South Carolina Republican Senator Jim DeMint plans to introduce a bill to do just that. What are the implications of this?
Well, it's a different kettle of fish with NPR because they are a membership-driven organization and they do receive some public money. But I would just say that any news organization has its standards, and people may not like them. I mean, NPR was also in the news when they had this memo that leaked out to the public last week saying that their journalists shouldn't attend the Jon Stewart rally on the Mall. I teach this. My students, we look at and we compare the ethics codes of various news organizations. Most all of the big ones have constraints on what their people can do. And when their people step over their lines, they get fired. They just don't get fired as publicly and as messily as Juan has been fired. They don't get investigated. But I'm glad the conversation is out there because, you know what, we have a lot of blurred lines now in the news media. What is analysis versus commentary? What saddens me the most is that both the reputation of Juan Williams and of NPR are getting sullied in this exchange.
How might this affect the political environment upcoming, the elections, and political campaigns?
You know, it's not going to change the outcome of how many Republicans or Democrats win or lose their seats, but it adds to the white noise and the sense of anger and disillusionment and anxiety out there, and I think it will feed the anger. I do.
Frank Cesno is director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. Frank, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We're going to spend a few minutes now talking about what Iraq looks like today. Our next guests say despite the lack of a government, the country has actually changed for the better since the darkest days of the insurgency in 2006 and 7. Bobby Ghosh was Time Magazine's bureau chief in Baghdad for 5 years. Today, he's the magazine's deputy international editor. Nate Rollins spent 2 tours of duty in Iraq as an army captain. After that, he was an intern at Time, and now he's studying at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. Together, they returned to Iraq recently, and they join me now from Time Magazine studio in New York City to talk about what they found. Nate, I want to start with you. You were in Iraq as a soldier when things were really bad. What was it like to go back then as a civilian?
Well, 2006 was a very tough year for us. I was in a unit that lost 19 soldiers over a year-long tour and 11 in a bad, very bad 5-month stretch in the early fall. So before going on this trip, I was deeply worried that we would find an Iraq that really hadn't had much progress since the last time I was there, which was about a year and a half ago. And a lot of my resentments were that our losses would have been in vain. But we found a Baghdad that was considerably different. There were people going to shops and restaurants. There were very few attacks. There's a large security posture with the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police. And so we found a Baghdad where things are still very tenuous, but the security forces that were shaky at best when I knew them are doing a much better job now.
Bobby, what were you looking for going back? And what was your thinking going back with Nate, who had been a soldier there while you were a journalist?
A big attraction of having Nate come with me was the opportunity to show him my Baghdad, to take him to places that, as a soldier, he would not have been able to go during his 2 tours there, to take him to my favorite neighborhoods, restaurants, have him meet friends of mine, and get a sense of what life was like on the other side, if you like, how it feels to be in Iraq if you're not wearing uniform, you're not in body armor, you're not in a armored Humvee. As Nate says, we found a country that seems very keen to get on with things. There is a lot of frustration with the politics and the fact that there has been the 7-month-long stalemate. But at some level, many Iraqis have come to the conclusion that they can't allow themselves to wait for their politicians, and they're just getting on with things. So there is commerce, there are new shops, there are new restaurants, and they're full. In the evenings, people bring their children out to the banks of the River Tigris in Baghdad to have picnics. And these are things that even a year ago, certainly 2 or 3 years ago, were almost unheard of. But Iraq wants to move on, whether or not its politicians are able to do that.
Nate, I was struck by the photo at the beginning of your article in Time. There's some kids in a large pool. They're in these bumper boats. It almost looks like it could be in California or Florida someplace. I imagine that's a Baghdad that you did not see when you were there in 2006.
That was a complete shock to me when we were able to go down by, that's the Abu Nuwas Park, down by the Tigris River. And that was a really amazing experience to see families out there basically having a picnic, children playing in the pools, because these are children who have known pretty much nothing but war for most of their existence, for most of their life. And so it was really heartening to see that they were able to be a normal child and play and run around, and that parents were able to picnic, and young people were able to walk around like any high schooler would love to. So that was a really, really amazing sight for me.
You also visited Mamoudia, south of Baghdad, part of an area that was known as the Triangle of Death. Fierce Sunni battles there against American troops. Nate, I know this is where you saw your first combat. I wish you'd tell us about that.
I patrolled an area just outside of Mamoudia on Highway 1, and we saw our first small arms firefights, our first roadside bombs down in that area. It was an area that did have fierce fighting for a long time. It was an amazing experience to go back there, and I felt the familiar sort of tingling sense and seeing the old landmarks. And then when we got down to the area where my unit and I were first ambushed, I couldn't believe that I had been back there. It had been over 4 years since I had seen that area. But then after that, we went into Mamoudia itself, and that was a city that was pretty much hell on earth for a very, very long time. And Bobby and I were able to walk through the market, and we were able to meet with the city council leaders, and they were having a meeting, and it looks like progress is coming slowly. Still very much a shaky situation, but it looked like it was coming along.
Bobby, you described the last time you were in Mamoudia in 2005, and you write that your biggest worry then was getting killed by an American soldier. So what was it like today?
The reason I wrote that was because I grew up in India, and because of the color of my skin and the way I look, I often was able to pass for an Iraqi. From 2005 onwards, Mamoudia was so dangerous. There was a lot of American soldiers there who were on a razor's edge, and I had gone in there with a group of Sunni sheikhs who were very supportive of the insurgency, and some of them were active participants. And I was called to witness a meeting that was taking place. And everybody at that meeting was concerned that American soldiers would come crashing through the undergrowth and start shooting. And I was the only person there who was not armed. Of course, even if I had been, I'm not sure I would have cared to shoot back. But now you drive through those same highways, and you find there are people on the side of the highways with little kiosks selling soft drinks and snacks, which is a very jarring image in the best possible way. It was almost surreal. Highway 1 has always been one of Baghdad's better roads, but now when you drive through this tarmac, you see little patches off cemented over the road, and you realize that that is where there had been an explosion of some sort. An IED had gone off, or an American convoy had been attacked, and the road has been patched over from the damage. There are markers there of all the hardship that Nate and his comrades at arms had to endure. At the same time, there is change, and there's much less violence, and there's some semblance of commerce.
That's Time Magazine's deputy international editor, Bobby Ghosh. We're also speaking with Army veteran Nate Rollins, who served two tours of duty in the Iraq War. Together, they traveled back to Iraq recently to see how the country has changed.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about Iraq with Time Magazine's Bob Ghosh and U.S. Army veteran Nate Rollins. Bobby Ghosh is Time Manager at Time Magazine's former Baghdad bureau chief. Nate Rollins served two tours of duty in the U.S. Army in Iraq. They're just back from a return trip to Iraq, which they write about in the magazine. I'd like you both to talk about what you found in Fallujah. Of course, the city where some of the bloodiest battles of the war were fought back in 2004. We remember that picture of the bodies of the American contractors hanging from that bridge. I found your descriptions of Fallujah a bit dispiriting. Am I reading that correctly, Bobby?
Well, it's six of one and a half dozen of the other. On the one hand, you drive through Fallujah today and there's virtually no sign of any of the violence. Two great modern battles involving the weight of American armor were fought on the streets of this town. And when I was there in the summer of 2004, in between those two battles, the city looked devastated. Every house had suffered quite a lot of damage from tank shells, from machine gun fire, from bombs. You drive through Fallujah now, and someone who really knows the town has to point out the one or two buildings that still carry those scars. The American military has poured millions and millions of dollars into the city in compensation, and a lot of that has gone into reconstruction and repairing all the damage. You could see that, if you like, as a sign of progress, as a sign of rapprochement. On the other hand, you talk to the people there and you ask how they feel about the Americans, and there's not a spirit of forgiveness there. Too much damage was done, too many people were killed, and repairing these buildings has not repaired the way people feel about the United States.
In fact, Nate, your host in Fallujah, who was a very powerful tribal sheikh, said something very interesting, I thought, to you. He said, the one lesson that Fallujah taught the world is this, quote, if you fight the Americans long enough, they will eventually pay you to stop shooting at them.
That's one of the really difficult parts of fighting a counterinsurgency. It's a very bad precedent to set, I suppose. But it was exactly what needed to happen at the time. And the Sunni awakening began a little further out in Ramadi, but then it sort of swept through those areas. And that was a large part of how, with those partners, we were able to defeat al-Qaeda in the Anbar province. And so while it is a bad sentiment, it definitely needs to be studied as a method of fighting a modern counterinsurgency war.
Bobby, Nate mentioned the Sunnis, and there have been many recent stories about Sunnis who were members of the Awakening who are now rejoining the insurgency. Did you see that, and why is that happening?
It's happening because there's a perception that the way politics has played out in Baghdad, that the Sunnis may find themselves once again out in the cold. And Sunnis are resentful of that. The ups and downs of modern democratic coalition politics are fairly new to Iraqis. And the Sunnis, at some level, don't understand why, when they came in from the cold and went and voted in this election, why they should find themselves outside the cabinet and not have a strong say in the government. There's also a very strong sense of entitlement. This is the community, although it is a minority in this country, has ruled Iraq for 1,400 years. And then you have a lot of former insurgent fighters who joined the Awakening. They were promised jobs. They were promised that they would be absorbed into the Iraqi security forces, into the Iraqi government. More than half of those people have not gotten those jobs. Those who have got the jobs aren't being paid on time, many of them, and that does not sit well with their perception of who they are and what their rightful place is.
Nate, what is the American military presence in Iraq right now?
Well, right now, the American military, for the most part, is just waiting to go home. I was able to go and spend an entire day and night with an old friend of mine who's in charge of an explosive ordnance disposal team. When things happen, as in the two bombings that I wrote about, the American soldiers have to be asked to come and help. And part of what they do is document the scene of a bombing, almost like a crime scene. And it took hours, sometimes 8 to 12 hours, for the Iraqi military to finally say, you know what, we can't handle this. We need you guys to come on out. And the really ironic part of that is that one of those bombings, the worst attack, came after the end of combat operations, and it was one of the most brutal attacks that any of these soldiers had ever seen. And some of them had done 2 and 3 tours and had seen some pretty bad carnage before.
Nate, you and Bobby made a video for the Time website, and one of the things that jumped out at us was a scene from a former prison. Can you tell us about that?
There was out in Hamdiya, there was a former al-Qaeda torture prison. I think it was an abandoned chicken coop that was probably a solid half mile from any houses. And the folks that lived out there said that they could hear the screams of people being tortured even a half mile away. And it was almost like a living nightmare. It was a place where I think you could imagine being dragged to in the middle of the night, being brutalized, and then most of the time I wouldn't imagine even killed. And then we found a piece of a human jawbone that our translator buried in the dirt, and that was a very, very powerful moment to watch.
Bobby, is there an image or a story that you want Americans to know from your recent trip to Iraq that you would like to describe?
For me, the most remarkable thing was basically just how much the economy was humming along. You listen to Iraqis, and they're all concerned that there aren't enough jobs. They're all concerned that there's far too much of a security presence, that it gets in their way. And, of course, everybody's terribly worried about how the politics is playing out. On the other hand, as I said, there are shops and restaurants that are open all the time, that are being opened all the time. There are supermarkets the size of Trader Joe's. That was, for me, having spent so many years in that city, that was, to me, the most dramatic image of this trip. I don't want people to get the impression that it's all wine and roses. Things are still quite fragile. And despite this progress, there is every possibility that if the politics doesn't play out right, things could go back to the worst days of 2006 and 2007. But right now, at this moment, Baghdad feels like a better place than I've ever seen it.
That's Bobby Ghosh, Deputy International Editor for Time Magazine, and Nate Rollins. He served two tours of duty in Iraq, and he's now studying at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. There are links to their reporting on their return trip to Iraq at HeroNow.org. Nate and Bobby, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up Monday on Here and Now, the Florida governor's race. News is next, Here and Now. Clashes broke out at an oil refinery just east of Paris, where French riot police shoved aside striking oil workers today in a bid to reopen the refinery. The workers' stand at the site had become a symbol of union resistance to the French government's plan to reform the nation's pension system. The government wants to raise the retirement age from 60 to 62 years, saying the reform would save about $80 billion and help France maintain its credit rating. Unions say the reform puts an unfair burden on workers, and union-led protests have crippled fuel depots and refineries across France. More than 3,000 gas stations have or are just about to run dry. Workers have forced airports closed and affected all public services. Despite the continued protests, the government is pressing ahead with its reform measure. And with more strikes promised, we have this report from the BBC's Matthew Price in Marseille, where the garbage is piling up because the rubbish collectors are just not working.
Well, the wind is really whipping up the rubbish here, blowing paper down the street, and everywhere you go, you find this. Big cartons of rubbish, bags down here, and a load of oranges just lying there, rotting away on the side, milk cartons. It's pretty miserable. This isn't the cleanest of cities at the best of times, but right now, after more than a week of strikes, the rubbish on the streets is beginning to take its toll on the people who live here.
Very, very dirty. It's a bad picture of France.
It looks like a science fiction movie. It smells like a revolution or something like that.
Still, life certainly hasn't ground to a halt here, but it is being seriously affected, and you can see that most vividly on the forecourts. Well, as you can hear at this petrol station, there is still some petrol flowing, although half of the pumps are empty, and we're told that the rest will be empty by the end of the day, assuming no delivery is made. The manager's just come out now. Let's have a little word with him. Right, that's interesting. He says the prices have gone up. The government said that shouldn't be happening, but the prices have gone up here just a little bit. And what does he think of the strike?
Nous, mort avant nous. Nous, ça veut dire enterré avant 67. Pas de retraite.
Okay, so as far as he's concerned, the strike's a good thing. He says if the government gets his way, they'll all be dead, workers like him, before they manage to take a state pension. And as for the effect on his business, he says he doesn't care. It's the company that's losing out, not him, so he fully supports this strike. Well, here on the beach, just a short distance along the coast from Marseille, you can see the root of the problem. I'm right next to France's biggest port. There are, across the sparkling blue waters of the Mediterranean, about 43 ships that I've counted. There are many more along this bit of coastline. They're anchored, of course, unable to get into port because of the strikes. The police here say they have managed to break some of the blockades, but it's just unclear at the moment as to whether that means some of these ships can actually get into shore, bring their fuel to land, and get it back into the petrol stations.
Tout dépend de la base, hein. Vous savez, c'est la base, hein. C'est eux qui décident.
Further along the road, there's a group of strikers.
C'est la base qui décide.
One of them, Karim, says the protests will carry on until the unions tell them it's all over. He also says a lot will depend on how the government responds.
Je suis d'accord, mais regardez, le gouvernement, on peut le faire plier. Pourquoi?
Here in the city centre, some of the shop managers have got their staff clearing up the piles of rubbish outside their stores.
It's been piling up, and I've been unavailable to open the stores for 3 days now, and I'm losing a huge amount of customers because they don't know that, you know, the other side of the store is open. So
what do you think then of the strike?
I mean, you know, they have their reasons, but I think there's another way to do things rather than taking people hostages.
For now, the unions say they do have widespread support here. How long, though, can it last?
That's the BBC's Matthew Price reporting from Marseille, France. The European Commission is taking up stricter rules for offshore oil drilling and thinking about temporarily suspending permission for new oil platforms in European waters. This comes as the Obama administration has lifted the blanket ban on deep water drilling, imposed after the Deepwater Horizon explosion killed 11 workers and spewed millions of gallons of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. Despite that disaster, interest in deep water drilling continues. Chevron recently announced a major new drilling project off the coast of Great Britain. So why is there so much oil in the ocean? Believe it or not, people used to think oil came from dinosaurs, as you hear in this 1977 ad from the oil company Chevron.
The next time you jump in your car, remember, some prehistoric creature gave his or her all for that tank of gas. So go easy, and America's energy will go a lot further.
As you might imagine, scientists today have other ideas about how oil was formed. With us now, Warren Allman, professor of paleontology at Cornell University and director of the Paleontological Research Institution in Ithaca, New York. Warren, welcome.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Jane.
So dinosaurs a little far-fetched, but scientists do think that oil and natural gas, which are chemically very close to each other, come from living organisms. Isn't that right?
That's correct. And the reason for that is pretty straightforward. If we boil you and me down into our constituent chemicals, many of those chemicals have a lot in common with the chemicals that are found in petroleum and natural gas. Oil and natural gas literally are the highly modified remnants of once living material.
On your website, you have an interactive of how it actually works, and we'll link our listeners to it. But walk us through the stages of oil formation briefly.
The first thing you've got to do is have the organic material, the living material, single-celled algae, or plankton, something that's really, really abundant in the ocean. Organisms form, they die, they fall to the bottom. Now, if there's a lot of oxygen at the bottom, then bacteria will eat up all the organic molecules and they won't accumulate. So you ideally need a low oxygen environment. That organic material doesn't deteriorate and so it piles up. And eventually you get thousands of feet of sediments on top of that organic material and you start squeezing it, and as a result of squeezing it, you heat it up. And it's those conditions of heat and pressure that alter what was once living organisms into these modified organic materials called petroleum and natural gas.
Organisms living at sea are the ultimate source of oil, is what you're saying, and that's why there's so much oil in seabeds themselves.
The consensus is that most petroleum and natural gas originated as marine organisms. So, for example, the oil that we used to drill for in Texas and in Pennsylvania, that comes from ocean, too. It's just very ancient ocean.
I found it really interesting that most of the oil we get from wells is not really in a pool. It's actually mixed in with sandy material, almost like a liquid from a slushy or something. Is that true?
That's a good analogy. So after we've formed the petroleum in what's called a source rock, a shale, which is a fine-grained sedimentary rock that's black because it has a lot of organic carbon in it. So think about a rock like that, a rock made of very fine-grained sediments like clay and mud that contains all this organic material. Now, think about the slushy example or a very thick milkshake. If you stick a straw into those and you suck on it, it's sometimes hard to get the liquid out. That's the same problem that you have for extracting petroleum from these source rocks. So Most petroleum is not produced from the rocks in which the petroleum originated. Most petroleum is produced from rocks called reservoir rocks. And so that means there's something else has to happen. So the petroleum forms in this source rock, and then it migrates. And why and how it migrates is not all that well understood, but it moves into an adjacent rock that basically has more space in it.
More porous.
More porous, exactly. You stick your straw in that, and you suck the petroleum out.
So, Professor, is it true that we generally only extract a fraction of petroleum from a well before that well is closed up?
Absolutely. So there is what's called primary production, which is sticking your straw in. Go back to the slushy example. You suck on it until all you've got is ice crystals, and then you put it away until it melts a little bit. And you might go back and get secondary production, and that involves some kind of treatment of the reservoir rock with water or chemicals or steam or something. But it's always the case that we don't get anywhere near all of the oil out of a reservoir.
What are the things that you look for when you're trying to locate an oil reserve?
Source, migration, and reservoir. You have to find a place underground where a source is nearby a reservoir so that the source could have the petroleum and then migrate it into the reservoir. So you need to look for places like that. Some examples would be an ancient reef. So reefs have lots of nooks and crannies in them. Much of the oil in the Persian Gulf area is produced by reefs that were formed during the time of the dinosaurs, for example.
So basically you're looking for porous rock next to where oil was created.
Exactly. Another example is what are called traps. And in the Gulf of Mexico, pillars of salt have actually moved upward into the overlying sediment and trapped little spaces. And so much of the oil that is drilled for in the Gulf of Mexico is coming from around, over, adjacent to these salt domes.
Professor Allman, let me ask you about toxicity, because there has been some debate about how much damage the oil has actually done in the Gulf of Mexico. Your center has been looking into this. What are you finding?
We actually don't know very much about the toxicity of petroleum to marine invertebrates, clams, snails, lobsters, things like that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that, as we all know, oil is filled with kind of chemicals that give you headaches and make you sick. That's true for you and me and also an oyster. That's kind of obvious. What we don't know are the long-term effects on things we really can't see. If the oil is really floating around in the kind of water column above the bottom but below the top, will that be affecting larvae that aren't on shore where we can see it? Another big unknown, will organisms start accumulating the toxins? There was that research around the Exxon Valdez oil spill, like the old DDT story, where one organism consumes the oil, another organism consumes that organism, and as you move up the food chain, it becomes more and more concentrated. We don't know a lot about that in ocean ecosystems. So, unfortunately, the Gulf spill is going to be a giant experiment that's probably ultimately going to teach us a great deal about the toxicity of oil, but right now, we don't know anywhere near enough to make really good predictions. The Gulf has been overfished, treated as a sewer, suffered all kinds of insults. Whatever the results of the oil spill, the Gulf needed help already.
Professor, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Warren Allman, professor of paleontology at Cornell University and director of the Paleontological Research Institution in Ithaca, New York.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. With so much heated political rhetoric this year, what is the political catchphrase of the season?
Man up, Harry Reid. You need to understand that we have a problem with Social Security.
That's Sharon Angle, the Republican nominee and Tea Party favorite who's running against Democrat Harry Reid for U.S. Senate in Nevada. After she used that phrase, it seemed to catch on. Here's Sarah Palin at a rally in Reno.
Hey, politicians who are in office today, some of you need to man up and spend some political capital to support the Tea Party candidates instead of doing this, waiting to see how everything's going to go.
So why is man up suddenly so popular, and which political phrases are resonating with voters this season? For a look at that, we welcome Ben Zimmer, the on-language columnist for the New York Times. Welcome back to Here and Now, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Tell us, why did that phrase, man up, make such an impact and spark so many news stories when Sharon Engel used it recently?
Well, it's interesting. Man up has been used frequently in political debates over the past year or so. But it really resonated, I think, when we had both Sharon Engel in Nevada and another woman, Robin Carnahan, who's a Democrat running in Missouri, telling Roy Blunt, the Republican candidate, to man up. So that actually happened on the same day. Engel and Carnahan both used this expression. And that really struck people as a very interesting development that that you had female candidates telling their male counterparts to man up, which seemed to possibly call their masculinity into question if you read it one way, or was simply, you know, just a call to be responsible, to do the right thing.
Right. In fact, Harry Reid responded in the debate with Sharon Engel saying he never had to prove his manhood to anyone. I'm curious, what was the public response to those comments, just generally speaking?
I think there was some outrage in some corners because this whole idea that you have to talk about being a man and acting tough, and that whole talk coming from female candidates, do they need to actually say that as opposed to just saying simply take responsibility, that sort of thing. Mm. And some people pointed out there's a kind of asymmetry here. You can't say to a woman, woman up, that wouldn't be a possible retort.
Well, that's right. I mean, the impact is different when a man uses the phrase versus a woman, I guess. I mean, I see New Jersey Governor Chris Christie here using that phrase, challenging people who were questioning his physical appearance to, quote, man up and say, I'm fat, end quote. So there is some asymmetry, I guess.
It's definitely true. And it's just interesting to see how sort of gender and politics are getting intertwined with the recent usage.
We mentioned that Sarah Palin used the term man up. How else is she using language on the campaign trail this season?
Well, one big contribution that she made is talking about the mama grizzlies. Sarah Palin was always very good with an animal metaphor. When she first burst on the political scene, she, of course, had that joke about the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull being lipstick. And then even just last year, when she was resigning from the governorship in Alaska, she had her comment about only dead fish go with the flow. And so now we have Mama Grizzlies, and this is kind of a rebranding of what previously had been called perhaps soccer moms, hockey moms, and so forth. And, she put out this commercial where it has her talking about how, don't mess with the Mama Grizzlies. You thought pit bulls were tough. Well, watch out for Mama Grizzlies. So she's using some Alaskan animalistic metaphors, which, the way that she talks about it perhaps is a powerful rhetorical move, even if it's not exactly clear what Mama Grizzlies, what they're supposed to represent.
I remember the cover of Newsweek, Mama Grizzlies, with all the four candidates across the country. There it was. Let me touch on one last turn of phrase that may be coming back to haunt, actually, President Obama as he stumps for Democrats, and that is the term shovel ready. How has that phrase backfired, and how is it becoming a campaign issue, Ben?
Well, it's interesting. If you think back to 2008 when Obama was elected, that's when we first started hearing this word shovel-ready quite a lot, and it described these infrastructure projects that were supposedly ready to go, that the economic stimulus package that Obama was going to enact would be automatically converted into these infrastructure jobs. And then it turned out to be a lot more complicated than that. And President Obama acknowledged that in a recent interview in the New York Times magazine, where he said there's no such thing as shovel-ready projects. Well, conservatives pounced on that particular comment and, of course, played back clips of President Obama talking about shovel-ready projects and saying, what is he saying now? Now he's saying there's no such thing. So that's kind of come back to haunt him in a certain way. The kind of optimistic rhetoric from late 2008 after he was elected president, now, he's coming to grips with the reality of the situation, and it's a lot more difficult. Mm.
Let me ask you about how political satirists like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are using language to target politicians. Next weekend, of course, Jon Stewart is holding this rally to restore sanity while Colbert is hosting the March to Keep Fear Alive. I want to play a clip of the pair talking about their rallies.
People should definitely book their hotel rooms now, or their children might turn gay.
No! No!
Yes!
That is not the result! They should book their rooms now, because it will be more difficult to get a good room if you wait.
How are these two comedians twisting language in different ways this political season, really to make similar points?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, they both have a way of puncturing overheated political rhetoric, but they do it in very different ways. I mean, even just from that clip, you could hear that Jon Stewart is taking the rational and reasonable route. You know, he's talking about restoring sanity, which is kind of a play on Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor rally that he had previously. While, of course, Stephen Colbert goes the route of just putting on this persona where everything is just so overheated, it just becomes absolutely ridiculous. And so he can sort of serve as a foil to the rationality of what Jon Stewart's trying to do. So they're using language, satirical language, in different ways, but really trying to achieve the same goal.
You interviewed Stephen Colbert about the most famous word he coined, truthiness, which recently celebrated its five-year anniversary. Colbert told you that he came up with that word truthiness at the last minute. But what was he trying to convey? Why did it catch on, do you think?
It's interesting. He told me that originally they were just going to use the word truth on that first episode 5 years ago when they were doing this segment called The Word, kind of a play on Bill O'Reilly's talking points. But he said it wasn't silly enough, and he wanted a silly word that feels wrong in your mouth. And what he was talking about wasn't really truth, but just kind of an approximation of truth and what you feel from your gut without having to worry about those pesky facts. So he said it's not truth, it's truth-ish or truthy, and that's how he came up with truth. And it really did seem to resonate. You know, 5 years later, we find that word being used, and it's not just about Colbert, but in lots of situations, like reviews of the movie The Social Network, for instance. People talk about the truthiness of that movie, how, you know, in terms of comparing it to the reality of how Facebook developed. And so there are all sorts of very interesting spin-offs, and the word truthiness has actually even entered the latest edition of the New Oxford American Dictionary and actually credits Colbert.
Ah, what's your pick for the best word of the year this year, the best phrase? Last note.
We'll have to see. You know, Man Up might be in the running. We'll have to check it out at the end of the year.
Ben Zimmer is the on-language columnist for The New York Times. He's also executive producer of The Visual Thesaurus. To read some of Ben's work, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Jane Clayson. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.